Age of Vision radio show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. From 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV radio, we relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision radio show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Fission radio show. Today is April 16th, 2018. It's 8 o'clock in the morning here in Eugene, and as usual, it's gray. Not a shock. So thank you for joining us. I want to get right to it. We have a guest, a friend of our show, Chuck Johnson, who used to work for the Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. And I think he moved up in the world because he got a job with ICANN. Who won the Nobel Peace Prize this year, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. Is that correct, Chuck? Is that who you work for?
Well, I work for IPPNW, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, and I'm on the board, or what they call the International Steering Group for ICANN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which won the prize. But IPPNW was one of the founding organizations. It was the initiator of the ICANN organization 10 years ago. 11 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Now,
I see how that works. And they also won a Nobel Peace Prize in 1985. So that is pretty. And you just moved there. Now, you are not living on the West Coast anymore. You're in Boston, I believe it is.
That's right. I'm sitting here with the sound off, watching the Boston Marathon in the pouring rain, the cold pouring rain and high winds.
So people are still doing the marathon.
Yes, I'm in Boston now.
Wind or rain. So tell us, what is the focus of this organization that you work for? What do you guys call it? IPPNW?
Yes, we do. Yep.
Okay.
It's funny, these doctor organizations that oppose nuclear weapons have gone in different directions in terms of their naming. One is Physicians for Social Responsibility, which is kind of a long name and it doesn't really tell you what we do. And then when the international organization was formed in 1981, it's actually the daughter organization of the national organization, ironically, even though we have 63 chapters worldwide, we call affiliates. But they went the other direction and just explicitly said what we do, but it also ended up with a very long, hard-to-pronounce name. So, anyway. But at least when you do learn our name, you know what we do, which is we work to oppose nuclear weapons and work for their abolition.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see you have an interesting title. It's called the Director of Nuclear Programs. That's kind of a funny title, Chuck, I have to say. But, you know, on the website, and I encourage people to go there, IPPNW.org, and look around and actually engage with this organization, because they've made a lot of inroads on getting some sanity into the dialogue, I should suppose. But it says that you're responsible for coordinating the medical and humanitarian consequences of nuclear weapons. What does that mean? It's coordinating the Federation's work. Yeah,
coordinating our work on that. The origins of Physicians for Social Responsibility in the early 60s was around a series of papers that were written and eventually in 1962 published in the New England Journal of Medicine on the medical consequences of thermonuclear war. And that has been the basis of PSR's work, and then has been the basis of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War's work since 1981, when one of the original founders of PSR, Dr. Bernard Laun, co-founded IPPNW with a doctor from the then Soviet Union, Yevgeny Chazov, to jointly work and work in other countries around the world to just educate people about how devastating and horrible even using one nuclear weapon would be, let alone the thousands of weapons that the two superpowers possessed at the time and still possess at this time. And so, you know, unfortunately, because after the Cold War, people began to feel less nervous about nuclear war and kind of forgot that it was a threat. People need reminding that we are within 15 minutes at any given moment of having a nuclear war. We're still on hair trigger alert with, in this case, it's now Russia, not the Soviet Union, with enough weapons to destroy life on the planet virtually. Maybe some bacteria and some other life forms would survive an all-out nuclear war, but it would be doubtful that human beings could. Even a lesser nuclear war, if we've been working with scientists who've done modeling of the amount of dust that would be kicked up from nuclear weapons that would block out the sun for a couple of years, depending on how much how many weapons were exploded, causing nuclear winter, which would be the thing that would have catastrophic consequences worldwide, well, regardless of where the weapons were used. And even up to, if only India and Pakistan fought one another, it would be somewhere around 300 to 400 nuclear weapons would be exploded. That would put 2 billion people, 2 billion with a B, at risk of starvation due to crop failure.
What's that number that you said if they were to fight each other? Why is that number so exaggerated? In my mind, I would think that because we do live, right, especially now, not even 2 years ago, we didn't have the same great risk because of Trump in the White House. I mean, mm-hmm. I think most Americans are now wondering if we're going to wake up, A, if we're going to wake up with Trump in the White House, or B, we're going to wake up one day with the threat of us saying, you know, some country has dropped a bomb on somebody else. And in my mind, I'm thinking that one nuclear bomb would be enough to shock people. I mean, I can't imagine.
Tremendously, of course.
I can't imagine that they would drop multiple nuclear weapons, that there would be any retaliation by anyone. If there was any country that dropped a nuclear weapon anywhere, I mean, it would be.
Well,
but then again, Trump is in the White House, so everything that's beyond comprehension is feasible. So.
Well, it's also just the way that these things are set up. The reason that India and Pakistan was chosen as an example is that those countries are on hair trigger alert with one another. They're worried that if the other side decided to try to attack and knock out their nuclear weapons capability, that they could do it. And so they're in a situation of launch on warning, just as we are with Russia. If the missiles are coming in and it looks as though they're trying to knock out your arsenal, then you either sit there and let them destroy your nuclear capability, or you fire them and release your weapons so that they can also inflict damage on your enemy. And that's the position that we're in with Russia, and that's the position that India and Pakistan are in with one another. And they call it deterrence, you know, because it's so horrible. It would be so horrible. It would be suicidal to get in a war like that. The trouble is that we've had some close calls because people, due to different malfunctions or different situations we've been in, have been under the impression, decision makers have been under the impression at times, that such an attack was occurring. And only through their own good judgment, they have the authorization to start nuclear war, you know, full-scale nuclear war. But because of their good judgment in these cases, they chose not to do that. Well, we don't have good judgment in the White House right now. I mean, that's pretty well demonstrated. And we're also relying, in the case of Korea, you know, a lesser nuclear threat than Russia. But we have a leader in North Korea who's paranoid that the United States might try to kill him. Well, it's actually not really paranoia, because if you look at our behavior toward Iraq and Libya and their leadership, that's exactly what did happen. They did not have nuclear weapons, and those two leaders are now dead. So you could understand why, if North Korea felt that they were being attacked, even if it were a small attack, they've talked about, the United States has talked about giving North Korea a bloody nose, which would be an extremely dangerous thing to do. A limited attack on North Korea, it would be difficult for North Korea to tell whether the attack was limited or whether it was going to be attempting to kill their leader or whether it was going to be attempting to knock out their nuclear weapons capability, in which case they would be very likely to think, well, now's the time. We might as well go down swinging. And tens of millions of people could die in a case like that, including some U.S. soldiers and possibly a city or two in the United States, depending on how well the North Korean arsenal is actually working. And, you know, we don't really know the answer to that. But we do know they have the capacity to kill tens of millions of people in South Korea and Japan. And, you know, it's a horrendous situation we find ourselves in. But as you say, it's made people aware of the fact that we still continue to have, as President John Kennedy referred to it, a nuclear sword of Damocles hanging over our heads at all times. And that's even after the end of the Cold War, that hasn't changed, unfortunately.
I just wonder how many countries actually have nuclear weapons, to be clear. Do you know?
Nine
nations on the planet are holding the rest of the world hostage, in other words.
Correct. That's right. And they were supposed to, under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, be working toward the total abolition, and actually, you know, that's part of the treaty, is the agreement in 1968 that was brought into force in 1970, you know, made a deal with the non-nuclear weapon states that the nuclear weapon states would be working toward abolishing them, and the non-nuclear weapon states would agree not to develop nuclear weapons. Unfortunately, they also, part of that agreement was that they would share nuclear technology so that they could develop nuclear power. And so the right to nuclear power, to the peaceful use of nuclear technology, is also in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which ironically makes it difficult to make sure that countries are not breaking out of it. This is the whole issue with Iran right now. They were developing enrichment technology for their uranium that is useful for making fuel for nuclear power plants, but also can be used, if you continue to enrich that fuel, to make nuclear fissionable uranium for nuclear weapons. And we just signed a deal with them under the Obama administration that they would cut back on their enrichment to only supply their reactor. I think they have two reactors at this point, for commercial purposes, and agree to forego any additional enrichment for 10 years. And now Trump's threatening to throw that whole agreement out.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's been a complicated dance. Yeah. It's been a complicated dance since 1970. And unfortunately, the nuclear weapons dance partners have not been doing. Because that's when the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was ratified into law.
Okay, so in my view, that treaty basically is about pile of hooey, because saying that you're going to use nuclear energy but not nuclear weapons is talking out of both sides of your mouth. Because nuclear power plants are what's necessary, right, for nuclear weapons. If they really want to get down to it, that's, I think, you know, this is the thing.
Not entirely.
They're not really spending money on nuclear energy, making it safe. They're not trying to find any way to... they're still in denial about the harm it's causing. 100%.
Well, that's true. And it doesn't deal with that at all. But no, you definitely can have nuclear weapons without nuclear power. The United States had nuclear weapons before it had nuclear power.
What about Russia? The vice had nuclear versa? Weapons. I'm talking about the other way around. We have nuclear power plants because they still want nuclear... They want to have that... Just in case. It's like being a just in case Christian. You know, we believe in Jesus just in case it's real. Well, this is why they have nuclear power plants. Just in case they need a nuclear weapon, it's already in the makes, because they can't.
No, it's not true in the United States at all. I mean, maybe some countries might not have enough fissionable materials to make weapons, but I think everybody has. There is so much waste that's already been generated from existing nuclear power plants around the world. That the United States, we overproduced the amount of plutonium that we needed for our arsenal by about triple. And
wow.
We still have, plutonium breaks down very slowly. So it's still readily usable. We have large stockpiles of plutonium that we could use to make new nuclear weapons if we wanted to do that. So we don't need nuclear power to make more nuclear weapons.
Wow.
We don't need to make more nuclear weapons, you know, because we have, with 1,500 weapons that are in service right now, and another, I think, I forget the exact number, but 1,000 or something like that, additional warheads that we could use that are on sort of standby.
Wow.
You know, we have way overkill. In terms of the weapons we need for even their deterrent theory, to maintain the deterrence, as they call it. And, of course, the optimal number is zero, which we should all be going toward as rapidly as possible. And that's the opposite's true right now, unfortunately. All the nuclear weapon states are engaged in some sort of modernization program for their nuclear weapons.
So they're not at all.
They'll continue to have them.
Right. They're not at all committed to going nuke free. Like, no, to say we should dismantle every single nuclear weapon.
There are very few countries that have done that, but a few have. The only one that actually developed nuclear weapons and then destroyed them and destroyed their capacity was South Africa. And that was mainly because the white South African government didn't want to turn over nuclear weapons capability to the black majority when they agreed to end apartheid. And then there are two other countries that got rid of them. One was Kazakhstan and the other Ukraine. When the Soviet Union fell apart, those countries had nuclear weapons stationed on their territory, and they agreed to turn over those nuclear weapons to Russia. So at this point, those are the only three countries that have had nuclear capability that have gone the other direction.
Well, what's the chatter inside your office? Because you're working on this issue every single day. Do you think that we're any closer to, like, really having a nuclear weapon used than we were, say, 5 years ago, for real? Like, I know there's a lot of bluffing and talking about it, but, I mean, is there a serious nuclear threat that we're going to have a nuclear weapon used?
Yes, definitely. I would say that the biggest danger is probably the North Korea-United States situation, especially with the people that Trump has brought in as his advisors. Mike Pompeo has had very aggressive has said very aggressive things about both Iran and North Korea. And John Bolton has called for attacking both Iran and North Korea to knock out their nuclear weapons capability. Mm-hmm. So, and he's the new appointment to be the national security advisor, because it doesn't require Senate confirmation.
That's right.
John Bolton has been a one-man wrecking crew for arms control treaties during his entire career.
Right. He hasn't seen a war he didn't love.
It's very dangerous. You don't have the only person who's close to Trump right now on military matters who seems to not favor attacking North Korea is Secretary of Defense James Mattis.
Wow.
And Mattis seems to understand just how dangerous that is, and possibly Pompeo does too. It's hard to say, but Bolton has never seemed to care about that. Things like that. He does things in a very aggressive manner. He was that way when he was the UN ambassador under George W. Bush. And he was one of the people who put us on this path with North Korea by rejecting any negotiations with them in the early part of the George W. Bush administration, when there was still a chance to maybe negotiate with them and keep them from developing a nuclear weapons capability.
Well, it wasn't, in my recollection, I remember thinking that before George Bush, North Korea did not have nuclear weapons, and they stopped the inspections. If I recall right, they stopped the inspectors from going in, and that's how North Korea was able to move forward developing this. Am I incorrect?
Yeah, that's similar. That's really close to what happened. That did happen, but that's not the whole story. The Clinton administration signed a deal with North Korea, with Kim Jong-il, the father of the current leader of North Korea, that they would stop the production of plutonium for use in nuclear weapons. And they didn't realize that North Korea also was developing the capacity for highly enriched uranium. And North Korea didn't bother to tell them that either. So they went ahead and started and continued with that pathway. And when that was discovered at the end of the Clinton administration, they tried to work out a deal, but they didn't have enough time to get it signed before W got in. And then Bolton and his crew said, forget it, these guys are cheating on us, you know you can't trust them, screw them, you know, we're going to rip up the old treaty and return to hostilities with North Korea. They didn't attack them, but they got out of that treaty, as you say. They stopped doing inspecting, and they just said North Korea's violated the spirit of the treaty, if not the letter, and can't be trusted, and they're part of the axis of evil. And at that point, with the other countries in the axis of evil, Iraq being invaded and threatening to invade Iran, North Korea said, you know, I guess maybe we should develop nuclear weapons, because this administration is into regime change, and we don't want to be the next victim. So that's kind of how that came down. And it didn't change after Obama came in. There was kind of another 8 years of drift, which would probably be a good sort of description of the Obama administration generally, in which North Korea continued to develop its nuclear weapons capability and exploded its first nuclear device. And then when Trump got in, he started becoming more aggressive with North Korea. But at that point, they have a nuclear weapons capability. And one of the things that always held people back in the past was that their conventional arms and their chemical weapons and their biological weapons capacity is enormous. They already, without nuclear weapons, had the ability to kill millions of people, including all of our service people in South Korea, which I think is somewhere around 16,000 people. And then we also have service men and women in Japan who would be vulnerable to attack from North Korea using either chemical weapons or conventional weapons, which they have an enormous firepower. They are the demilitarized zone and a giant battery of missiles and artillery is within range of Seoul, which is one of the largest cities in the world. I think its population is somewhere around 12 million people, something like that, and even larger for the surrounding area. And they could just rain death on Seoul with no problem whatsoever and didn't need a nuclear weapons capability to do that. So they were not somebody that the United States thought in the past was a worthy target. Ironically, by developing nuclear weapons, they've actually made themselves more attractive to some of these more way-out theorists like Bolton for an attack, which is extremely dangerous. And they can justify that attack by saying that North Korea threatens the United States, especially as it develops longer-range missiles. So we are, according to Well, I was just going to say, according to the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, who every year publish this graphic called the Doomsday Clock.
Right.
They've been doing this since, I think, 1949, sort of estimating how close we are to an annihilating nuclear war. They moved us closer than we've been since 1953. So they think that the Trump administration and the situation with North Korea and potentially the situation with Iran has taken us closer to nuclear war than we've been in quite a long time.
What do you think will happen with Syria? Like, this is the thing. It's also sort of lining up with this thing in Syria, too, because it seems like people are sort of drawing sides. It sort of reminds me of these little instances that happened right before World War II and also before World War I, where there was these conflicts that people were getting involved in. Like, to me, Syria seems like that little ticking time bomb that could set off the whole thing.
I think that that's something people were really nervous about for the last couple of weeks. However long it's been since the chemical weapons attack triggered the United States reaction to it and Trump making a lot of very bellicose statements. But this is where General Mattis has kind of stepped in, and Trump deferred to him in terms of doing an attack that was in the middle of the night, so not likely to have as many casualties, attacking facilities where people were not likely to be at night, and limiting it to that and not a general all-out war with Assad that then would threaten to bring the United States and Russia into conflict with each other. I think they went out of their way not to have that happen. And for whatever reason, Trump, you know, whether the Russians have something on him, as some people have said, and there's some sort of his behavior sort of makes you believe that might be the case. He has one thing that he has done is he seems to be very anxious not to get into conflict with Putin or with the Russians, which is to the good, you know, in this situation right now that we find ourselves in.
Yeah, that's to the good, because to be honest, Russia could definitely hold its own against us. I mean, this is the thing with nuclear weapons. Let's be clear. Even if you have a bad nuclear weapon, it's still a big nuclear weapon. You know what I mean? A small one is, there isn't any one that wouldn't do serious damage and cause massive pain to, frankly, everything, the world economy, to the human race. I mean, it would be really, it's beyond comprehension that we even have these weapons, that they're even considered part of our arsenal, because the devastation.
Well, the little ones, you know, they have this thing called the National Posture Review, which they do, Nuclear Posture Review, which the U.S. government does every 5 years or so, and the Trump administration just did one. And they're talking about using smaller nuclear weapons, developing classes of smaller nuclear weapons that might be more usable in the battlefield. But then somehow, because we would have these usable weapons, it would deter conflict. You know, and it's interesting logic that they employ for justifying building new weapon systems that enrich large corporations. But in any case, these so-called small nuclear weapons they're talking about, some of them are the same size as the ones that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So those, that's what the little ones are like now. The big ones are much larger. So, you know, there's no such thing as a truly small nuclear weapon. They're so absolutely destructive in so many ways. Just the blast and the heat to start out with, and then the radiation, that, you know, the immediate radiation, and then the long-term effects that people are still suffering from who were subjected to these bombings in Japan, and also to the nuclear weapons testing that occurred around the world.
Chuck, I have a question to ask you that is kind of sort of off, but and then I want to ask you another question after that that's completely unrelated, but I do have a question. Like, you're working for an organization, and so you've been working on this for a long time, according to your biography on IPPNW, for quite a long while, right? Like, you've been involved with this on a regular basis most of your adult life, with this idea of stopping nuclear, from 1990 at least, right? You've been engaged in this. And also, your director, Michael Crist, has also been involved since the 90s, for a long time. 20, 30 years, all of your adult working life, it seems, has been a major focus. All of these organizations that have been out there, and the good ones are few and far between, IPPNW, ICANN are among the strongest, Physicians for Social Responsibility, but really there's a handful, maybe 10 or 12, right? But all of these people engaged in making this effort to, A, stop nuclear weapons, acknowledge that nuclear is detrimental and harmful to our environment. It's like we up against the wall for 30 years. How is it that the message, how is it that we kind of, like, in, I used to say this to you before when you were working for Physicians for Social Responsibility about closing the Columbia Generating Station. Their only focus really is always only about money and never about the harm and the complete denial that nuclear is really so much more on a scale detrimentally worse than any other type of weapons. How is it that we've been hitting our head against the wall for so long? Like, why are we making progress? Does it just look like we're not making progress? Or are we getting there? Or do you get my question?
You know, I mean, this is something that has been, you know, it's been a problem for the world since the dawn of the nuclear age, which is, you know, goes back before I was born, obviously, and I was born in 55, and I started working on nuclear power issues in 77. And then when Reagan was elected in 1980 and started talking about winning a nuclear war with the Soviet Union, a bunch of people got involved. A number of people who had been involved with the nuclear anti-nuclear power movement shifted to working on the nuclear weapons issue, and we coalesced around a campaign called the Nuclear Freeze Campaign, which had a very basic message that the United States and the Soviet Union should freeze where they are and not build any additional nuclear weapons, and then begin to negotiate themselves back down off the ledge. And it was extremely successful. It had Ronald Reagan was a popular president. He was elected twice. And he was extremely aggressive president with the Soviet Union. And we turned him. Public opinion was against him on that. And by the time he left office, we had a very good regime in the Soviet Union under Mikhail Gorbachev, who understood that it was time to end the nuclear arms race. And they signed agreements that essentially that ended the Cold War and began to reverse the nuclear arms race. And that was a direct result of people's action in the 1980s to turn that around. Unfortunately, we didn't finish the job. And a lot of that has to do with the way people think. When the immediate threat is gone, then they move on to other things. And I think for really a long time now, decades, it's been difficult for groups to get people interested in the nuclear weapons issue. When I took over at Nuclear Free America, I went back in 87 to work in the National Office of Physicians for Social Responsibility. And right about that time, we found that people were losing interest in anything dealing with nuclear weapons. And we were having to figure out, okay, how do we continue as an organization to be relevant? You know, do we need to expand the issues we work on? And you know, we want to keep working on nuclear weapons, but we can't pay the bills because people don't want to contribute money to work on that issue as much as they did. And when I came to Nuclear Free America in 1990, we were definitely in that mode. You had communities who in the past had declared themselves nuclear free zones. They were mostly focused on nuclear weapons issues and symbolic declarations that our community is a nuclear weapons free zone. And this was a worldwide movement that by the end of the 90s had completely stalled out. And we continued to promote nuclear free zones in the United States, focusing on nuclear power and nuclear waste and other nuclear issues. But even with that, we ended up having to close our doors in 97 because there just was not the interest to just maintain it. Now, PSR continued on and always has worked on nuclear weapons, and has IPPNW. And in part, it's due to the fact that being physician-based organizations, there's a certain amount of money that these idealistic physicians have been willing to put forward, and other people who support these physician groups, to keep these groups going through these lean years when people didn't think this was really an issue anymore. And now, again, people are realizing, yes, it's an issue. It's an issue that's just as deadly as it ever was. We now have another potentially cataclysmic issue, the issue of climate change, that has captured a lot of people's attention and imaginations, and rightly so. But this one is the sleeper. You know, we can I'm trying to remember who wrote this poem. I need to go back and Google it, but there was some say the world will end in fire. Others say it will end in ice. And that's almost a good definition of the two threats we're facing. The fiery threat, of course, is overheating the planet and the effects it would have there. The ice is if we had a nuclear winter due to the explosion of enough nuclear weapons to freeze the planet for a couple of years and kill off crops and plant life and therefore the rest of life that depends on it. And we're facing both of these cataclysmic events, potential events. One's happening in slow motion, the climate change one. The other one is just sitting there and could happen very rapidly if a wrong move was made by bad leaders. Or even well-motivated leaders who did not heed the situation and allowed a mistake to gain momentum to the extent that you had an all-out nuclear war. So you ask me how come after all this time we haven't dealt with this? Well, we had some victories. We didn't take advantage of those victories. I would say the two Democratic administrations in the United States hold a lot of blame for this. There was a lot of talk when Clinton was in office and at the end of George H.W. Bush's administration about cashing in the peace dividend, about, you know, having a more peaceful world and reducing our armaments and reducing our money spent on armaments. And they were just too cautious. They didn't want to offend the arms industry. There were a lot of jobs involved in that and spread very cleverly by these industries throughout our country and in all kinds of congressional districts. So, you know, ending nuclear weapons systems or ending any sort of military system becomes very difficult in our money-based political system in the United States. And the Soviet Union collapsed to Russia. And we kind of took advantage of their weakness. We set up their system of oligarchs and enabled it.
That's for sure.
Moved NATO to their borders. And then a leader rose up among the oligarchs who used nationalism and continues to use nationalism. Mm-hmm. Putin.
And used the system of democracy to keep himself in power. He basically manipulated it so that he basically has his minions all around him. It's interesting how right. he used the idea yeah. of having evidently like the it looks like they have a democracy, but they don't really, like, for real. And he's really got himself in permanent control.
Right. And in terms of practical control of military matters, the difference between their system and ours is not as great as maybe some would like to think it mm-hmm. is. You know, whether
Trump
the Democrats are in or the Republicans are in.
Trump is actually likely to see himself as a little mini Putin. I mean, I think he was really serious when he said that the United States should try not having term limits for presidents. I think he feels cheated. Like, he's just getting going, you know what I mean? Like, it's, by the way, that person right. that wrote the poem is called, that's Robert Frost, one of Robert Frost's most popular poem, written in 1920. It's a short, right. let me read it. It says, "Some say the world will end in fire, some in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice."
Yeah.
So who would think, now what they're saying now is that the world, I mean, this is, who is it, Guy McPherson, that's what he says, "Once the world goes without ice on the polar caps, we are going to be in a serious world of hurt, and it's going to cause a massive effect of climate, I don't know, change, or mm-hmm. it will cause like different temperatures and all kinds mm-hmm. of things. But that being said, we still have all of these nuclear, like, they're very intent on developing their nuclear arsenals all around the world. Every country, it seems like, right now, they instead of putting it down, they've actually picked up the mantle and seem to be running forward. So what are you currently working on now that you've moved to Boston? Before we close the show, I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk about what you're actively engaged in right now.
Well, the thing I'm working on, and what's really exciting about getting involved in this issue again, is that for the last 11 years, this ICAN movement has been building momentum as the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons. And I encourage listeners to go to the website of ICAN and be inspired. This group, IPPNW helped found it in Australia and recognized early on that it needed to broaden out to other groups. There are 10 groups on the International Steering Group, but there are 463 groups internationally that are partner organizations of ICAN and that have been actively involved in all the countries around the world pushing the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which last year, July 7th, in New York, the United Nations voted to approve this treaty, 122-1 against, with one abstaining, and then a number of nations, including the United States and the other nuclear weapons states and some of their allies, most of their allies, did not take part in that treaty. But 2/3 of the United Nations voted for it. And at this point, we're working with all of these partner organizations around the world to get those countries that do support abolishing nuclear weapons to sign and ratify this UN treaty and begin to treat it like other banned weapons or stigmatized weapons, like landmines was done, like chemical and biological weapons, which were made illegal internationally, and to put it into that category of a banned weapon, and
That's
then
good.
Work toward getting our allies and then hopefully the nuclear weapon states themselves to also sign onto this treaty and work to get to zero. And our goal is within the 2 years after the treaty signed, so by July of next year to have it go into force, and we need 50 countries to sign and ratify it. At this point, we have 58 countries that have signed it and 8 that have ratified, and we're hoping to increase those numbers significantly in the next several months. There's a meeting of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Organization in Geneva that's happening next week. And ICANN has organized campaigners to go to Geneva. I'm going to be going to Geneva in a few days to participate in this. We're going to be doing some lobbying of the delegates there and trying to increase those numbers and get ourselves up to where we're at least we have that the treaty into force, and we can really begin to work on the nuclear weapon states and what they call the nuclear umbrella states, or the countries that are in military alliances that use nuclear weapons as part of their alliance. So I'm feeling hopeful that we, you know, we're on a good track. The Nobel Peace Prize Committee in Norway chose ICANN as the recipient this last year. The 2017 Nobel Peace Prize went to ICANN, and it was a recognition both of this achievement of this treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons, but also a recognition of the additional threat posed by President Trump and Kim Jong-un and all of the nuclear weapon states. And with a message, I think, that the Nobel Committee was sending out, that this issue is extremely important and that ICANN is on the right track. So I'm really excited about working for this group. I feel really lucky to be involved in it, and I'm hoping that we can, in the United States, you know, the immediate concern that we have and that PSR is working on right now is supporting efforts in Congress to take away the president's right to preemptively start a nuclear war. It's one thing to react to a nuclear attack. I think it would be difficult to get Congress to agree to tie the president's hands if we were attacked by someone else with nuclear weapons. But the decision to attack another country with nuclear weapons should not be something that is left in the hands of President Trump or really any other president. It really ought to be, it's the ultimate declaration of war, which is supposed to be under our Constitution, something that's reserved to the Congress. And so there are mostly Democrats, but a few Republicans who have indicated that they think that this needs to change, and hopefully, probably after this election in 2018, there may be an opportunity in Congress, and of course, we can continue to advocate in the United States now for setting those kinds of limits, and then begin to have the conversation about whether or not does this nuclear deterrent really protect us, or does it keep us under constant threat? And I think it's the latter. I think we can make a very convincing case that it's the latter. And since it's the latter, we need to start negotiating with Russia and the other countries that have nuclear weapons to seriously negotiate down to zero with extremely intensive inspections to make sure that we can make that we can catch anyone who tries to break out or cheat. And that's going to be the task of the United States anti-nuclear weapons movement. Going forward, I think, is to, with the support of the rest of the world, get our country to obey what we hope will be a treaty that goes into force worldwide and to join a treaty.
That's the hard part about our country. We've entered into lots of treaties and don't even honor them. And so I think that's the hard part about getting people to sign into a treaty with the United States, because the United States is on a kind of, we'll sign this treaty until we decide we don't want to. That's their attitude. You know what I mean? It's not like a treaty is supposed to be something you don't cross a boundary, right? But the United States doesn't have a good reputation. Our government doesn't have a good reputation for honoring what it says it's going to do. So, I mean,
yeah,
as much
it's
as
a
we
problem.
Like, it is. It's a huge issue. And the idea that we're going to, okay, this is why people don't want to give up their nuclear weapons on the other side, because there is no, you can honestly look at the United States and see that they have no intention of ever stopping developing their nuclear arsenal. Like the people that are in But that's my question. I read an article that said... Go ahead.
Okay. No, I was just going to say, President Obama, tantalizingly, in 2009, gave a speech in Prague talking about going down to zero, and then of nuclear weapons, you know, of negotiating down to zero, and then never lifted a finger to actually go there afterwards, unfortunately. So it has been conceived, but as you say, there's enormous amounts of pushback from the industry that's involved in making money in this, and also people who are military theorists who think that deterrence is the right way to go. Maybe in their own minds that they don't trust other countries, and they see the world in a way that as always being a hostile place. Unfortunately, we know that if we stay in this state of deterrence, at some point an error is going to happen, and then we really will have a nuclear war. And so it really isn't, it's not, you know, neither side, both sides have their risks, but we know for certain that we're going to have a nuclear war if we continue to have arsenals.
That's true.
At some point, someone will use them.
And if we don't constantly talk about it and push back, that's absolutely
right.
True. The only thing that will make them think about maybe we shouldn't do it is that there's a lot of pressure. And that was my question earlier. I read an article about maybe a month ago or a month and a half ago that said that the generals, that even if Trump gave the order to push the button and start a nuclear war, that the people in the military probably would not obey him. Do you think that's true?
Well, I don't want to have to find out.
Me either.
Because, you know, that seems like a really risky thing to count on.
Yeah,
People in the military are trained to follow orders of their superiors.
Right.
I mean, it would be personal, in terms of their career, it'd be career suicide to.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that it could be deemed treason because you're disobeying what the president has ordered you to do. So, but this is the thing: we're at this point where we have a president who is emotionally unstable. It's pretty obvious he's emotionally unstable. And
the Republicans,
it's obvious why they're not challenging him, because they want to get through their neoliberal agenda of, you know, enforcing privatization on everything. I mean, they have an agenda that they're going to enforce before they get rid of this guy. But that takes us back to what happens in the meantime with these nuclear weapons. And, the threat of nuclear war seems to be getting greater and greater, because this thing with Kim Jong-un and in North Korea, we really are not clear about their nuclear capabilities. And, you know, that mountain did actually collapse, their experimental mountain that, you know, left, what, a 50-meter hole and escaping nuclear. I mean, they are full in on the nuclear arsenal. So when they say they want to have talks with the United States, I personally don't trust a word that guy says. And I don't trust a word our own government says. So the masses of us are left here sort of, I don't know, prepping.
The thing that there are a couple things that worry me about the situation with North Korea. Number one is Trump's general attitude. Actually, three things that worry me. His general attitude, which is sort of very cavalier attitude towards life generally and the use of nuclear weapons. He said, he's been all over the map in his discussion of it. It's like, why do we have these things if we can't use them? He's asked several times. And then he even at one point, the thing that got Rex Tillerson, his former Secretary of State, to call him a flippin' idiot, that's not a direct quote, a flippin' moron, was that he was talking about, hey, you know, we need to build more nuclear weapons. You know, let's do that. And basically, that's totally ridiculous and unnecessary. But he was talking about doing that just to make us seem like we're more muscular under him. You know, that why we had at one point more nuclear weapons. why don't we have, I'd like to have the most nuclear weapons of any president. I mean, that's kind of the simplistic way that he thinks about them.
It is.
Then number two, the other thing is that he's brought people into his administration who are sociopaths, and I'm thinking specifically of Bolton, especially, and don't care a whit about life, and have all of these bizarre ideas about attacking Iran and North Korea, which in the case of North Korea could result in a nuclear war. And then the third thing is, as the Mueller investigation gets closer and closer around Trump, he's, you know, he constantly distracts people with his weird tweets and weird things that he does. This could be the ultimate weird thing that he does if it gets too hot for him with the investigation. He might want to try and rally the country around him by having a full-on war with Korea, with North Korea. I'm very worried about that. That's why the Congress needs to take away his right. Congress needs to take away his right to start that war. Because I think if things get too hot for him, he'd be tempted to. It's one of the things he could use to try and rally public opinion in his favor, which, you know, because that customarily that happens when once we get into a war, people rally around a president and believe the explanations that a president makes for getting in a war. He understands that, you know, he has, as dumb as he is in so many ways, he has, the street smarts and survival smarts, that, don't have any limits, unfortunately.
It's
going to be an interesting few years.
Hopefully we will get him out of office. And I mean, this is, we really are on a precipice. This is why they moved the doomsday clock to, like, we're at 1 minute to midnight or something, 2 minutes to midnight. It's dangerously close, and it's a real danger. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know many Americans who basically have this constant threat of anxiety about what's going to happen today, and it's real. It's not some made-up thing because of the nuclear weapons. So, Chuck, I really appreciate you spending your life and doing this work, because as we've all seen, just challenging the nuclear industry is not easy, and staying constant on it is a challenge. So I really want to thank you for doing that, because the work that you're doing is mega important for the survival of humanity, even if it is 50, 60, or 100 years. You know, none of us want to go up in nuclear flames.
It's also mega fun. So anybody who wants to get involved in it is going to feel very, I think, satisfied doing it. And I know that most of your listeners are probably involved in some way or another, and I encourage them to get even more involved.
Yeah, and it does really matter. And by the way, there is a meeting up in, I'm going to have some information on that tomorrow morning, up in Washington about the nuclear industry. It's about Hanford. So it's up in Olympia at the state capitol. There's a thing going on. If people want to show up, I'm going to, even though it's tax day, I'm hoping that I can get my work done today and drive up there. So look, Chuck, thank you for joining us. I encourage everyone to please go to the website that IPPNW and find out what they're doing. I really appreciate you joining us, Chuck. I hope you'll come back and share more of the work that you're doing after you come back from Europe and tell us what the news on that front.
I'd love to. Thank you. Thank you for having me, Lonnie. Thank you for keeping the show going. It's been great.
Well, I hope we make a difference, because it's obviously a big mountain to climb. And guess what? The only way to do it is over. So put your courage feet on, you guys, and we'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye, Chuck.
Thanks, Lonnie.